Are you guys ready to record this whole thing all over again?
I didn't care for it. I didn't buy it.
That seems pretty ridiculous.
I don't even want to think about the possibility of you having your dick out.
Yikes.
Is this the most important thing in the universe? What happened to it? I don't know.
I needed to suck in absolutely every moment of awesomeness.
Yeah. Welcome to another fun and festive episode of the Geek Legacy Podcast, where we talk about everything in the realm of entertainment news, so long as it falls under the geeky umbrella. I am Justin Cavender, and if you're keeping score, you should note that this is episode 350. Very excited about that. And with me, as always, Mr. Randy Van Dyke. How are you doing today?
I am lovely. We are nearing the weekend. Indiana Jones 5 has started shooting. There are birds in the sky and a song in my heart.
Oh, I like the sound of that. What about you, Dave? Do you got a song in your heart?
Kanbanwa, Justin. Ohayo gozaimasu.
Ohayo gozaimasu. Yes.
There you go. Perfect. I'm doing fantastic. We usually record on Thursday, but we're recording on Friday today. And, it's going to be a long and busy weekend like all of them are. But, it should be a good time.
Yeah, we're going to miss Full House and Family Matters and Step by Step and Perfect Strangers and all those amazing shows on TGI Friday, but that's okay.
I'm recording them on my VCR.
Perfect.
I set the timer, but it kept blinking midnight. I hope it's okay.
That's great. I read an article.
It'll record.
Right. I went down the rabbit hole, and I didn't think I realized that Urkel wasn't on Family Matters from the beginning. He came in a couple episodes later, and he was just like a special characters, and then everyone loved him so much that they brought him back.
Yep.
I did.
It was like super exaggerated and like, you know, what you would get from like a quote unquote freak of the week type thing. You know,
right.
He's in, he's out, he's memorable, and maybe he comes back later in the future. But then everyone loved that suspender wearing, glass wearing Urkel.
Cheese eating.
Cheese eating son of a bitch.
Yeah. I heard that caused a lot of anger in the rest of the cast, though, like they were being upstaged by the new character.
Like, you ain't get off the stage, man. You ain't show business.
Show business.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, I remember even my parents back in when it was airing, they're like, oh, the Urkel show? That's just what they called it.
Yeah. Who's going to watch? Are we going to watch Urkel tonight? Yeah.
Exactly. Just like my wife calls the Mandalorian Baby Yoda show.
There you go. Not anymore, right? Because he's going to be gone.
He's gone. Ain't no Baby Yoda no more.
Yeah. Still Baby Yoda show.
They shot Baby Yoda into the sun.
Like the nukes in Superman 4.
Yeah, Luke Skywalker is like, yo, I'm busy. I got this nephew I gotta deal with. So, sorry, bro. You got to go.
Let me. I'll do what my dad did to kids.
Yeah. Killing kids. That's a good trick.
That's no good.
Anakin Skywalker, you rapscallion.
Yeah. You rascal, you.
You mentioned earlier that Indiana Jones 5 had started production. Is that what you said? Did you dream this, or is this actually happening? I'm confused.
I mean, it is both a dream of mine and a reality out there in the world that out in the UK, they have begun production on Indiana Jones 5. It had been reported last week that Harrison Ford had arrived out there and a few of the other stars that are said to be attached to the movie, like Mads Mikkelsen and Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And this could be a potential spoiler warning here, but even Marion Ravenwood herself, Karen Allen, was doing a Comic-Con over the weekend in the UK, not too far from the location where the shoot was going to be taking place. So that might place her in the movie as well, or at least she's in the right proximity to be in it, be involved. So yeah, just today I have seen some set leak photos from a rail yard where they were shooting, and they had it all dressed in the 1940s from the look of it. Do you guys want me to get into spoilers?
Well, 40 sounds like a flashback. Can't have Harrison Ford in the 40s, can you? Or like a digital de-age him, you think?
I would think it would be a de-aged Harrison Ford, because there's also a giant costume rack filled with Nazi uniforms. There's some Nazi hardware in the form of like some sort of like tank, and there's guard towers and all sorts of stuff. So it looks
just
like
a newsreel. Like, what if it's a flashback of a newsreel from that time?
I mean, it could be. Who knows? But okay, let's look at it this way. In Last Crusade, we had a flashback with a young Indy, River Phoenix, you know, seeing a seminal moment of his young life. Why not start Indy 5 with a flashback of a younger Indy, which just so happens to be Indy of the same era that we're familiar with from some of the other movies, of seeing some, like, maybe he's in a German POW camp and we see him escape. We see some great escape, you know, and it's a train scene, maybe not unlike the circus train from the beginning of Last Crusade. Who knows? But it's something involving trains and Nazis. And people are speculating it might be some sort of escape. Now, this is purely speculation based on set photos that may or may not actually be from Indiana Jones 5. This could be total bullshit. Other photos,
some guy taking pictures. just Nazi shit around Germany. It's gotta be Nazi shit around here.
It's in the UK, so it's not as ominous as Nazi shit just being around Germany. But there were also rumors of there's this like damaged castle, like broken down old, like medieval style castle that they were going to be shooting at as well. So they had a lot of film gear showing up there over the past week, and some people had posted some photos of that as well. So,
but how were the tapestries?
I'm wondering if it's supposed to be that same castle, because that would be pretty badass. But no, but
I'm
it just goes
to the next guy, Randy.
I was the next guy.
It just goes to show that we're going to see something happening kind of in the European countryside in this movie, which makes me happy. So, you know, even if we just get a small glimpse of Nazis in the form of a flashback, like at the opening of the movie to set things up, I'm loving it, because just like the even number Star Trek movies, the odd number Indiana Jones movies, the ones that have Nazis involved somehow in them, tend to be the better films. So even if they're just like somehow Nazi adjacent in this one.
Is that the karmic glue that holds the Indiana Jones franchise together, is Nazis?
I mean, if you look at it, like, Superman has his Lex Luthor, Batman has his Joker, Indiana Jones has his Nazis.
There you go. So you know, would you want
peanut butter and jelly, if peanut butter and jelly fought?
It's like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Yeah. So, I mean, do we want... Because, like, in Raiders, the quest that he's on at the beginning doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the movie other than, you know, showing that there are rival treasure hunters out there kind of thing, right?
Right. So, like, well, it sets up the Belloc being the villain that, you know, is, like, one step ahead of Indiana Jones.
Right. So, right.
Same thing with all of them, really.
But, I mean, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, there isn't... What he finds at the very beginning doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the story. It's more of the interaction that he has with another human that goes on to play a bigger role, which I prefer when so many movies we see something where something is dug up, you know, 200 years ago or something, or 1,000 years ago, and then that's our plot device for the rest of the movie. I like the indie way where he has an interaction with a human being that is going to catch up with him at some point in the rest of the movie, as opposed to an actual object.
Like the Cross of Coronado in
Belongs Last in a Crusade. Museum.
Belongs in a museum. So do you. Yeah.
The thing that seems to really kind of throw it off, though, is Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because we don't really have another MacGuffin at the beginning. Off. Well, yeah. But, I mean, at the beginning, we do see the arc, and that's kind of cool. So, I mean, but he's not there for that. It's like the whole thing is always, always, always revolving around this crystal skull.
Right.
So maybe that was its problem.
But aren't the bad guys introduced at the beginning? And
they are.
The refrigerator and all that stuff?
Yeah, that takes place later in the movie. But, yeah, they're introduced in the beginning. And yeah, it does.
Spell go.
I thought that was at the beginning.
Congratulations, Indy. You managed to make the Russians in the 60s boring.
Right.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
Well, I don't think it was quite the 60s. I think it was set in like 57 or something like this. This is still, last I heard, set to be set in the late 60s. Of the possible things that have been flying around the internet, is people are talking about it could possibly involve the space race, or it could involve like former Nazis hanging out in South America. And I say, why not both? Because
Indiana Jones in space.
In space, yeah. How amazing would that be? I don't want to see that, but
we saw it in Star Wars.
why not have, like, it opens in some sort of, like, prison camp, and we see some German scientist, and, you know, just as it's being, you know, maybe Indy learns of some nefarious, like, super rocket that he's developing or something like that, and, you know, steals the plans and escapes out of the prison camp or escapes out of the base, whatever this German compound is, and, you know, fast forward 20 years later, and this guy, it turns out he survived the war. He's been living in fucking Buenos Aires, and he's been continuing to develop his rocket technology, and now it's a race.
Like Goldeneye.
And now it's a race between, like, the U.S. government and this, you know, former Nazi power to see who's going to get to the moon first. Like, maybe he can be all buddy-buddy with the Reds at this point in time. Who knows? But maybe there's a Nazi scientist, you know, again, with rocket technology, if they're going the space race angle of it. Or I'm cool with the idea of it being something as terrestrial and not a cult as just, like, stolen Nazi gold, you know, and Indiana Jones is gonna, you know, get all this stuff back that had been stolen and, you know, spirited away at the end of the war, and, you know, keeping them rich and keeping them alive in South America, like, find all this stuff and repatriate it back to Europe. You know, maybe there could be some historical or religious relics in there, but, you know, it could just be something as simple and not religion-based as that.
It could be the continuum transfunctioner.
Yes.
Who knows?
Its power is revealed by its mysterious. I like. I think Magneto did a pretty good job of hunting Nazis in Buenos Aires. So yeah, if you could do like Magneto, that would be fantastic.
Just out of curiosity, so I went to IMDb because I was going to look up Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but I got a little sidetracked. There is this Spanish Indiana Jones movie called Indiana Jones and the Sanctuary of the Black Order from 2021. Oh. Have either of you heard of this movie?
I am intrigued.
It sounds like a fan film. Every once in a while, you'll see a fan film pop up that's like Star Wars or Indiana Jones or some franchise. And IMDb isn't as strict as they used to be in terms of allowing projects to go live. It used to be that everything had to be approved by a human, and there were hoops that you had to jump through to do it. But now, just about any schmuck, just like Wikipedia, any schmuck could submit something, and all of a sudden, hey, it looks real.
Hey, I'm a schmuck.
We're all schmucks, right? We could all be making it look like we're making movies every day. But in this case, I suspect it'll get taken down.
This is like Turkish Star Wars. The Ottoman Empire Strikes Back.
Exactly. Nice. With rocks on his feet to train.
Yeah.
And he's going to dip his cardboard sword into the gold paint to make the super weapon.
Yeah. It says, in 1938, a group of American archaeologists are taken prisoner in the castle of some German place. Indiana Jones, with Sala and Husani, will travel to the Nazi Vatican to discover the last and darkest plan of the Third Reich.
The Nazi Vatican.
That sounds weird.
I was not aware of a Nazi Vatican.
The poster is right up your alley, Randy. I'm not going to lie.
Does it have the Nazi
Vatican? Well, I might have to look at this now.
Okay, so here's a link to the poster. But yeah,
and what's it called again?
It is called Indiana Jones and the Sanctuary of the Black Order.
Yeah, y el Sanctuario de la Orden Negra. I mean, I dig the Nazi with the effed up face, the Freddy Krueger Nazi, and all the Nazi ladies. But I mean, this is clearly like. I mean, the art isn't terrible, but it's like an art class project. You know, it's got some rando dude as Indiana Jones and definitely not John Rhys Davies as Sala. And they've got the full-on truck from Raiders of the Lost Ark. yeah. It's fun artwork, I'll give you that, but it is definitely...
I'm not gonna lie, it's like a half step up from the G-Stream King here.
Right. Just did he say bootleg? Yeah, this looks great. I don't know. I think it would be fun, especially if we had a couple of drinks.
Short round.
Oh, yeah. I love cheesy movies, so count me in.
You're in.
Hey, there's even a trailer, guys. Holy crap.
I know, that's what I was watching. Yeah. I was skimming through it.
So we'll have to make a date of this.
I think you made this movie, Randy, with the G-String King in
1994. Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be my peak era for making Indiana Jones stuff.
It is, in fact, in Espanol.
Yeah, but you know what? Unlike my movies of the late 80s and early 90s, when I was an awkward adolescent and tween, this one actually has a female in it. Oh. I couldn't talk women into being in my movies when I was a kid.
Yours was more Shakespearean, where we had men dress up as women.
that's no joke. Like any female characters. My very first film I ever made in 1988, I made Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money. And it's just like this 30-minute just fiasco of me and my friends running around playing multiple different characters, because there were only like four or five of us. But any line that I needed read by Princess Vespa, because I couldn't talk any girls at the tender age of 11 to be in my silly little movie, my mother would be reading from the script off camera, so you'd hear this female voice disembodied, and then me dressed up as either Dark Helmet. We all played two characters. I was both Dark Helmet and Barf.
That's rad.
You know, yeah. And Dark Helmet, I just wore my Darth Vader helmet that I bought at Disneyland without the front faceplate, so it was just the black outer shell. Yeah, it was good times.
That sounds amazing.
It's terrible. I remember, so I said it was like a 30-minute movie. Let me tell you, 20 minutes of which was this climactic scene at the end that was supposed to be the ship blowing up, and it was a little cardboard model that I had built, and I had put ground-up model rocket engines and match heads in it, and I was trying to light it to get it to light on fire so it would explode on camera, and I couldn't get it to light. So then I ended up dousing it with lighter fluid, and finally the whole thing just, it didn't explode, it just burned really aggressively. Yeah. And it's literally you're listening to the Spaceballs soundtrack on cassette in the background in my backyard next to my parents' pool on this little square of cement, and just watching for like 20 minutes this cardboard thing burning.
I don't know what it is with that rocket stuff. Those little cylinders where you would put in a rocket that would shoot up and the parachute would come down, basically. That I never understood how those work, because it was plugged into that little that blue control box or whatever, and then I turn the key, and then it takes off and goes. I was like, I don't know how this shit works.
Well, there's one little piece of the puzzle that's important to connect those dots that you've got drawn there, and that's the igniter. So the little blue box with the button on it, there's a 9-volt battery inside of there, and then there's basically like speaker wire that runs over to where you're launching the rocket from, and both of the ends of the speaker wire get connected to two little wire leads on our model rocket engine igniter, which basically just kind of looks like a wishbone, like a turkey wishbone kind of thing. And at the top of it, where it comes together, there's like this little black resin kind of looking material. And when you send the electrical charge to the two little metal wires that come out of that, the black part at the top glows, it gets really hot and just kind of sizzles. That's what ignites the model rocket engine.
Okay, so you obviously perfected the explosion, because fast forward to like 2006 and we're out in the middle of the desert and you hand me a battery and two speaker wires and you say, okay, there might be a delay. I touch the speaker wires to the battery and poof, the big ass explosion. It worked.
So, yeah, between 1988, the very first time I did that, and then 2006, the incident that you're describing, in which some poor French soldier almost lost their life because they lost their helmet before stumbling into where the explosion was going to be.
It looked pretty real.
Yeah. Yeah, the big difference was I stopped using somewhere in the late 90s. I stopped using the model rockets because I found that if you take a slit, you cut down the little cardboard tube that they're inside of, you can unroll it and then pull out just the powder inside, and it's like a hard substance. You put it into a bag, break it up with a hammer, and then you have this gray powder. And then if you put it like inside of little ships or buildings or whatever, and then you had one of those little igniters that I was talking about, you could run some speaker cable, attach it to a battery, and then poof, things would be able to explode on command. So I started like properly blowing up miniatures as I got more advanced in my filmmaking, right? And There came a time where little miniature explosions weren't going to be enough. When I was making a film about World War I, we had to have big explosions and trenches. And this was fast forward to about 1998, 99, when I first realized this and learned how to make this. I went to where we shot the place. This is a total detour, but I hope you guys don't mind taking this journey with me. Sure. So we found this place where they do World War I reenactments in Southern California. And I'm not going to say where it is because it's – I don't think it's still an active site where they do it anymore. But it's technically private property, so I don't want people to find this place because it's badass. There's trenches and bunkers and barbed wire and stuff like – all built in there, and it looks amazing. So they've got, they did years and years of full weekend long events where they would have, you know, a whole bunch of people being Germans and a whole bunch of people on the Allied side, and they would do mock charges back and forth, and they would fire blanks at each other and set off controlled explosions. It was amazing. I'd learned about it online, and I decided, because I was looking for a location to shoot my World War One film while I was like, it was my thesis film in college, you know, in film school. This is like the ultimate thing that I was building up towards wanting to do was this World War One film. And I was looking for a location. I found this group called the Great War Historical Society, found where they did their reenactments, and I went out there at the beginning of one, and I saw these big explosions going off, and it was amazing. And I was sitting up on a hillside with a 16 millimeter camera with a black and white reel of film in there, and I was shooting all of it from a distance. And then when I got it developed, I used it as a newsreel. I was like, newsreel footage. It looked amazing. It was so cool seeing these big explosions and like dozens of soldiers getting out of the trench and charging the other side. It looked fucking like real, like you were there, and I could not get over how cool it was. So anyway, I came back at the end of the weekend after the reenactment was over, and I was talking to my connection that I had met online through there, and he was telling me about some of the explosives that they use. Basically, they would just get black powder, like you could get at any big sporting goods store that sold any kind of like guns and ammo and accessories and stuff. You can get this black powder, and you just set it off remotely the same way that we were setting off little explosives all my life up to that point. And that's how you get the big explosions. You just have to make sure there's not any rocks or dangerous debris sitting on top of where you bury, you know, your black powder charges, so that they're it's basically not shrapnel being sent out. So I'm like, okay, cool. I could totally do that. So then fast forward to when I was actually out there shooting my thing. I couldn't get the explosions to work, and I couldn't figure out why. I went to the sporting goods store. I got like 5 pounds of black powder, and I made little 1 pound charges, which, I mean, looking back on it, if anybody would have like walked into my apartment, well, there it's about the size of like a softball, and it's wrapped in duct tape, right? It looks like a fucking bomb, right? And it's just got like these two little leads hanging out of it that I would connect a wire to. Then I just need to connect the other end of that long ass wire to a 9-volt battery, and pop, the whole thing goes. So I couldn't figure out why they didn't work. So that during that World War One film, I could never get big explosions to work. So I ended up kind of having to do some special effects to make it okay. Well, fast forward to 2006, we're back out at the same location, and I'm helping another friend with a World War One short film that they want to make. And this time I've been practicing. I've learned a new technique to set off the said explosions. You had to bury them deeper, and you had to make like cardboard tubes, like thick walled tubes, like mortar cannons. And if you bury them deep enough and make sure the ground underneath it is solid, everything will blast upwards instead of like a ball of explosives where it goes equally out all directions, including, you know, if there's soft ground below it, you know, you make sure that the blast is directed upwards. And damn if it didn't work. But this was also the first time that I've ever done it that close to humans before. And I wasn't like a kid or anything. In 2006, I was like 29 years old. I was a grown ass adult that should have known better than to set off explosives near actors and friends and extras and stuff. But we had very clear areas. All right, you don't want to go anywhere near here. You don't want to go anywhere near there because there's going to be explosions, you know. And
it was the middle of the night too.
Well, yeah, we did some of them at night. We did some of them the next day as well. Because I remember
one, a solo one in the nighttime, and then there was a series of bombs going off.
Yeah.
As the early morning sun was coming up.
Yes.
And the charge was happening.
Yeah, it was this great. I remember it looking great. This film never got finished, so I don't know. I haven't seen it since then. And I remember one of the cameras got effed up from the explosion because it got like dirt all in it, and the footage got a little messed up. Back when the day before digital, everything was shot digitally, you know, we had cassettes, and they're a very physical medium. And if something happens to the camera, like if it gets too hot or if it gets dirt and grime inside, things can happen and it can actually damage the footage. But anyway, so we're orchestrating this charge where like 10 French soldiers were coming up over the top of the trench and they were going to be charging towards the camera. And we had like two explosions set to go off in this one shot, I think. And one of the soldiers, as soon as he got up over the top, he kind of lost his footing, stumbled off to the side. His helmet was starting to fall off because he didn't have it strapped around his chin. He had the thing where like they wore the little chin strap over the top of the helmet itself, over the brow of the helmet. So he's stumbling within feet of where this explosion is supposed to go off. And he's like clinging onto his helmet to try to keep it on his head. And at that point in time, the wire has already been touched to the battery. So it's gonna blow. And it's just a matter of how far away is this guy gonna be from it when it happens. And as soon as I saw him stumble, I just like held my breath. I was like, holy fuck. Cause I was behind a camera on the other side of the field. There's absolutely nothing anyone could do at that point in time to stop it if it was gonna be a terrible thing. Well, bam, the explosion goes. And thankfully, I think we brought peat moss with us too, and that was what we used to pack the top of the explosive. Right. We cleared out all the dirt, so that way you could tell an area where an explosive was going to go off because the soil looked really dark because it was peat moss. It was super super lightweight, and it was very fine. And I think in actual films they use a thing called Fuller's Earth, but that's really expensive and it's really kind of powdery and it makes really cool looking explosions. But this stuff was really really dark. You could buy like tons of it for like a couple bucks at Home Depot. So that's how you could tell where the explosives were buried. But anyway, yeah.
I think we actually went to Home Depot on the way out of town.
To pick up the peat moss. Yeah. Right. So boom, it goes and you see the smoke clear and the big brown cloud of just like the dirt coming settling back down. And you saw this dude's helmet fly out of the smoke cloud. Like it knocked his helmet off of his head. And then you just see him just like come tipping over, like stumbling out and then boom, hitting the ground. Like the stuff had gone around him sort of, and he just kind of emerged from it and hit the ground. And as soon as we called cut, because believe it or not, we didn't call cut right away. We had to let the charge continue, right? So we got the shot and then we called cut and they go running over to this guy. I'm like, holy shit, are you okay? His ears were ringing, but he was completely okay. No shrapnel, no major long-term damage or anything as far as we're aware of. But it was terrifying. And that was also consequently the very last time that I ever set off explosives myself. And if I were to ever think of doing anything like that again in another movie, I would make sure that a professional pyrotechnician is there.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the wires to touch to the battery.
Yeah, you would have been holding the murder weapon.
Well, I mean, the problem was is that we were doing a bunch. There was a bunch. So yeah. I had one. Randy had one. Yeah. You had one. And
it's
then,
like firing squad. We don't even know who really does it. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah. We don't know who did what. And I remember Scott was complaining because he had set his camera and then we'd set the charges and then he moved his camera and just none of us were – because I remember we were shooting at night, but we got there in the day to set up. Then we shot a bunch of stuff at night, and we were trying to get like the dawn shot. And then we were shooting during the day, and we were all just beyond tired. None of us should have been handling explosives at that point.
Yeah, because we've been up all night shooting all night.
I remember driving home.
The rock. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember driving home, and I was driving like a million miles an hour because I just needed to race to get to my bed. And I remember Justin was asleep in my passenger seat, and he looked up, and he looked at the speedometer, and he's like, "Thank you, David." Yeah. They went right back to sleep. I'm like, I don't know what he's. I guess he's thinking because he's getting home quicker. But
yeah, it was a drive. Oh well, that's unfortunate. Moving on. Cruella 2. This is a thing. Disney's already got Cruella 2 in the works with a sequel. I believe it's called 101 Dalmatians.
I've already seen that one.
Right. Yeah. They've done a live action and an animated, and I think the animated got a sequel too. I think it was 102 Dalmatians.
Yeah. They only had one baby after all that. Sounds fishy. But anyway, I can't believe two things. One, I can't believe this movie was made. And two, I can't believe it's getting a sequel. But I suppose there was a Maleficent and a Maleficent 2. So there is precedent. Like, it makes sense, I guess. But
yeah, I mean, it made over $20 million in the box office this weekend. I mean, this was kind of like the first weekend with Memorial Day. You know, it was kind of the first weekend of semi-normalcy. You know, the box office was over $100 million for the first time since, you know, pre-pandemic. you know, Quiet Place 2 made, you know, $57 million. It made more its opening weekend than it did, than the original made. You know, that's a big part thanks to, you know, John Krasinski, who wrote and directed it, you know, really, really wanted to make sure that this movie was seen by an audience. Like, he knew that, like, we could have, yes, we could have dumped this on, you know, some kind of streaming platform, but he knew that, like, the movie-going experience really, really was something that would have helped this movie, and, you know, he's proven right, and, you know, people are goo-goo and gaga over it.
Yeah, no, 100%. And it's one of those movies that it benefits from the sound in the theater. I mean, it's all, the whole movie's about sound, right? So, I mean, you don't want to watch a movie like this in your living room. You want to watch it in a movie theater where it is destined to be.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Well said. Howard Johnson is right.
You don't want to be that guy watching a movie on your phone on the sofa. Like I do from time to time. Oh, jeez.
We all do it from time to time.
That's so crazy. But I mean, I remember when I watched Twister in the theater, and I thought I was in the middle of a fucking tornado alley, man. It was nuts. I thought that was one of the coolest surround sound experiences ever.
Yeah, I mean, the surround sound between, like, Dolby Atmos and all that kind of stuff, adding all the atmospheric speakers around the theater has just made it an even better experience since movies like Twister. It's just insane what they can do. And I'm loving it. It's so great. It's like I know I'm sitting over here being one of the biggest proponents for watching movies at home is great because you don't have to worry about being around crowds and screaming kids and this and that. But man, no matter how good my home sound setup is, it is nowhere near the experience that you get inside of a theater. And you know, your big tentpole blockbusters are always going to have amazing sound, and especially a movie like Quiet Place 2, where so much of it is based on sounds. The sound design is just amazing, and it really deserves to be experienced, if nothing else, regardless of the size of the screen, just in the proper audio environment.
Oh yeah, 100%. And video games have really stepped up their game when it comes to sound design and sound engineering, and playing with a pair of headphones on is a complete game changer, to use a buzzword in the industry. But like, it's insane when you have these headphones now with like 7.1 audio drivers that are able to deliver this insane quality of an audio experience. And if you're playing a horror game or like a space horror game, like Dead Space, perfect example. You know, there's all kinds of creepy crawlies coming at you. There's this station that is, or this ship that is in dire trouble. Everyone's dead. There's creatures coming after you. There's doors that don't work, and they open up really fast and close really fast. And the nice sound engineers are just going into like subway tunnels and recording trains go by. And you wouldn't know that unless you watched a behind the scenes documentary. But when you're hearing it, you're just like, oh my God, we're all gonna die. This is the creepiest, horrible sound I've ever heard in my entire life. And it's so nuts how we have come to this point. And it doesn't even have to necessarily be a video game to enjoy something with headphones. There could be one of your favorite songs from like the 80s or something like that, that when the music kicks on and you're wearing headphones, you're like, dude, I didn't even know there was a cymbal in this moment in the song, but I can hear it now in my headphones. And I think that's so weird. A song that you've loved and you've only ever heard on the radio, I challenge you to put on a pair of headphones, and I guarantee you will hear sounds that you didn't even know existed in that song.
What has continually blown me away is sound in VR games. Like if I'm wearing the full setup with the visor and the little flip down like headset kind of thing, and if there's a sound coming from something right in front of me, as I turn, you know, I'm hearing it as if it were in that fixed place in time or in space, you know. So the spatial sound is just fucking amazing, and it really helps immerse you into it. Right. It doesn't even have to be VR, just it could be something, just a function of video games in general. Sound design there is every bit as amazing and technically difficult as it is for movies, if not more so. I would even say more so, just because of how interactive things need to be. It's just fucking insane. But if I didn't make movies, if I didn't want to make movies, I would fucking go into game development, that kind of thing, and just do like sound design for games or even just like cinematography, because there's people that, you know, yeah, even with CG, there's still basically a director of photography that does like the cutscenes and, you know, decides what they want it to look like and what kind of simulated lens is being used and how the lighting is happening and all that kind of stuff. Like, I would still want to do something that felt like a movie, but video games are the next best place to do it in.
Yeah, it's crazy. You have more time. You're not limited to like a 2-hour movie. Now you might have, you know, a 10, 20-hour, 60-hour journey. a lot of storytelling to be had in a 60-hour game, believe you me.
Yeah.
It's fucking nuts. That's crazy. You know, you mentioned the VR experience, and I've shared the story when it happened years ago, but I was at PAX, and I was doing this VR experience where I was on this floating island, and it was very much like a Fantasia experience. You know, there's these creatures floating by, like giant butterflies. There's all these beautiful flowers and trees, and everything's kind of lighting up to the beat of the music. And it was really enchanting. It was this fantastical world. Loved everything about it. And like I said, I was on this floaty island. You know, I had the 360 viewing with my VR, and I'm just in this little makeshift office that didn't exist. It's basically four panels that were put up to make an office and a convention floor. And there's wires everywhere. And 2 minutes into it, something happened to where I was teleported onto this island, and I thought I was there, and I slowly started stepping to the edge just to look down, and it was weird that I forgot that I was in this office, and I literally thought that I was in danger if I got too close to the edge. And it was so crazy when my brain just flipped the switch and was all of a sudden convinced that I was on this now floaty island. It was nuts.
Yeah, VR is a mind fuck, but oh my god, I love it.
It really is. Oh,
so great.
I just want to play a game with a controller in my hand and a black box above or below my TV, and that'd be the end of it. I get scared with VR. It stresses me out. And they have like those crazy little parabolas that you can walk in, so you can walk in place, basically.
You can like walk or run in place. Yeah, yeah. That's a little intense for how I tend to dabble in gaming, but yeah.
Yeah, it's nuts, dude. I'm curious if we're ever going to get to an age where, at least in our lifetime, where a movie is a VR experience. You know, I did some cool stuff with Legendary at Comic-Con where they had like the Pacific Rim Jaegers, and you got inside one and you're being attacked by one of the kaijus and you're able to look around, and it was a very immersive experience. But I don't know if it's for everybody, but it was definitely cool. And it was mainly just, you know, like a 5-minute sequence of you stepping in, the fluid going in you, and then you controlling the Jaeger and then being attacked. But it was really, really cool. I just don't know how you would get multiple people in one experience. You know, like it's one of those things where if you have a theater with 200 people watching a movie, this might be more like 5 people watching the movie.
Well, there's a couple different ways you can look at it. Look at it like Disney. You go to California Adventure, you go on Soarin' or something like that. You know, that's not necessarily a VR experience, but it's something where like 100 people can, in front of an IMAX screen, like do the ride, and it's just like everybody kind of feels like they're flying, and it feels like a shared experience in an almost theatrical environment. Or even like the way they used to do the old Back to the Future ride at Universal, you know, where there's several DeLoreans, or if you peeked around the corner, you can see like a bunch of DeLorean time machines filled with people. And again, it's like an IMAX screen with a projection of what you're encountering. But something that they started doing a couple of years back at Not Scary Farm, really kind of, in my mind, it's almost sort of like a proof of concept for how you could do a VR horror film. But they would do a thing where they would strap a set of goggles on you and like put you in a chair and strap your arms down to where you couldn't move. And then the VR experience happening around you is basically like you are, you know, somebody who is like trapped in an insane asylum or whatever the situation is, and all this shit is happening all around you and you're experiencing it. You know, you could be watching one story in front of you and another one could be happening behind you as you turn around to look. It could be like the repeat viewing on something like that would just be off the charts. Now, sure, that works for like a 5-minute encounter. Would it work for a 90-minute feature? I don't know, but it's worth trying, I think, at some point. And even then,
when someone has like a mental breakdown, does the whole ride stop for everybody, or are you so immersed and your ride keeps going because you're wearing, you know, noise canceling headphones, you got the visor on so you can't see what's happening around you, so for all you know the person next to you had a heart attack and EMTs came by, grabbed them, saved them, took them away, and you wake up and now that chair is empty.
Well, I mean, they do it like they would any of the haunted houses. So you kind of wait in line and then you go through it in groups. So I imagine the wait time on this would probably be pretty long. And I just threw out 5 minutes. I really don't remember how long it would have been. But you know, just like any other kind of like walkthrough, ride through experience or whatever, just you do it in groups of people. So I'm sure it wouldn't be too crazy. And I'm also sure that they had somebody had to oversee it to make sure that it's not too scary to the point where, you know, somebody's not going to have a heart attack. But I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is, though. Like, if it feels immersive and it feels real, you know, or if you're just drunk or high enough to really believe that, you know, you're in that environment, who knows? You might have a heart attack.
Right.
They probably make you sign a waiver. I bet they probably make you sign a waiver before you even go in there. Like, all right, some pretty intense stuff. You got to make sure you're of sound mind and body.
Did you guys
like roller coasters? You can have a heart attack on a roller coaster.
That's true. That is true. Did you guys do the It experience at San Diego Comic-Con? I know that we all were there, but I don't know.
Yeah, which one of I us did it, in. And it can it can go jump off a fucking cliff. I'll never do anything like that ever again in my life because you hear Pennywise in the background. It's like I'll whisper, and I'm like, yeah, this is not for me. So I just learned. I realized that no one in there could see me. So I took my headphones off and I just closed my eyes.
Yeah,
and I was basically just sitting there in the dark. I was like,
Felix was like, closed his eyes too. He didn't watch at all.
Yeah, I was like,
that's funny. And that was inside the bus over at the Petco parking lot, right?
Yeah, it was terrifying. One of the things that Ready Player One promised us for the hopeful future is you would live your favorite movie. And so like one of the challenges within Ready Player One is, you know, Wade has to reenact the movie War Games. So he plays the Matthew Broderick character and he has to remember all like the lines. So it's kind of like a fun game slash, you know, different way to view the movie. So like at the beginning, he's actually playing Galaga and stuff and he's got to go through the whole day and stuff like that. You know, I don't think that'll happen in our lifetime, but I'm pretty excited that kind of stuff could happen one day.
Yeah, that's nuts. Cruella 2, the digital experience VR. You get the skin puppies and you're gonna hate every second of it.
Yeah, it really shows what an amazing job Emma Thompson does at being just a completely unlikable
Emma Stone? You know,
person. What
Emma Stone?
Well, no, Emma Stone is Cruella, but her the person that she is working for is played by Emma Thompson.
Oh, okay. And,
she is a terrible human to where you're actually rooting for Cruella, who is the world's most famous dog murderer, maybe second after Michael Vick. But, she's, like, you know, the only thing you know about Cruella de Vil is that she wants to murder puppies. That is her defining characteristic. And the fact that...
And wear them.
It's not, and not just, like, dogs or elderly dogs. She wants to murder, like, puppies. You would think she'd be, like, just let them wait a year, and they'll all be so much bigger, you can make so many more coats.
Right.
And the mere fact that we're actually rooting for this person is crazy.
I'm not.
Well, when you watch it, you will.
Maybe. She plays the Baroness Emma Thompson.
Yes.
I am a sucker for barons and baronesses.
Yeah, he is. I am the Baron.
I like Heinz the Baron Cross von Espy, and I like Baron Zemo, and now I like Baroness from G.I. Joe. So, and now I like Baroness Emma Thompson.
You would do very well in like European East autocracies. Europe?
yeah. Go hang out with the Count, maybe? And be like, hey, Count, what's up? Dude, I'm a Baron. Check it out.
Yeah. Just got to give you a Count or Baron title.
Yeah, I think that's all I have. Bad Batch? You guys want to talk about Bad Batch?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we had some fun in this past episode.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I enjoyed it. I think I needed this because I didn't really care for the episode prior to it. This one was kind of fun. I liked how they all got captured, and then Omega got to save the day, and we got a little Rancor action. This adorable little guy. What was his name? Moochie?
Moochie, the youthful baby Rancor. It's
right.
Giant baby. But,
So fast forward to the end, and he's getting taken away by our buddy Bib Fortuna. And I immediately got sad. Is Is this the same Rancor that is in Return of the Jedi that gets crushed by the door?
You'll be thankful to know that this that Muchi is not the same Rancor. Muchi is a female, and the Rancor that's killed at the end of the Jabba Palace stuff over in Return of the Jedi was a male, and the male's name was Patissa, which is Hutties for friend.
Oh.
You could speculate that maybe Muchi and Patissa were brought together to try to mate. Maybe they wanted to make some baby rancors to sell. Maybe that was one of Jabba's money-making schemes. I don't know, black market rancors, rancor babies. There's no word officially on what happens to Muchi later on. But according to Wikipedia, who I do tend to believe, the one from Return of the Jedi is not, in fact, the baby that we fell in love with in this last episode of Bad Batch.
Okay. Does this Wikipedia tell us if rancors are mammals or if they lay eggs? What are they? What is their jam?
That's a damn fine question.
They are mammals?
Yeah, they're mammals.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they technically call things mammals in the Star Wars universe, but
I mean, in that they care for their young, and you know that they give birth. I don't know what all the defining characteristics of mammals are. I apologize, I'm not a
5 meters tall, 1,650 kilograms, no hair, black eyes, brown skin. This is all information off of Jabba's Rancor on its Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm.
But we think they go to meet up with a Jedi informant named Sid, who turns out to be voiced by Rhea Perlman. Which I had no idea until you told me about it, you guys. I was like, holy shit, no wonder that voice sounded familiar.
Yeah.
Basically they're kind of forced to work for her, to pull some jobs for her. One of which is going to rescue this child. And they all think it's going to be a humanoid kid. And then it turns out to be this rampaging adolescent Rancor, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I dug it. It
was a little bit more of a lighthearted, fun episode, and it does pick up where the previous episode left off, because now they're in the process of trying to figure out who hired the bounty hunter that was after them in episode 4, Fennec Shand, who we all know from The Mandalorian. So they're kind of like trying to follow the breadcrumbs to figure out who's got it out for them, you know. Because it probably isn't the Empire, because I doubt the Empire would be dealing with bounty hunters. So, looks like maybe it's the Kaminoans. They want to protect their investment. Yeah, they want the kid back, and maybe see what they can harvest out of the Bad Batch, make some more like them, since they're like the Uber clones.
So I think one of the things I liked about it was they were back in their element, like a search and rescue kind of. Environment, I suppose. They didn't do too well, but it was fun to see them have some kind of plan, and then plans change, and then they have to evolve these plans, and then kind of MacGyver things, and I think that's where they shine the most, is doing stuff like that. And then I do like two episodes ago, I did like how Crosshair was sort of a mean guy. And there was the dark moment where they nuked that whole the firing squad thing. I thought that was pretty intense. So if I can continue to get some sort of mix of evil galactic empire and bad troops doing bad shit, and then the Bad Batch doing what they do best, and then these two meeting in the middle at some point, I think that I'm really going to enjoy this series.
Definitely. And we've got quite a few more episodes to go. I want to say there's 16 for the season. So, it's nice. Because I was also watching the Mighty Ducks Game Changers, and the last episode for that just dropped the same day that episode 5 of Bad Batch did. So, and I finished one series now. You know, I don't want Bad Batch to end too soon, because I don't have anything to look forward to on Fridays anymore. I know Loki's coming up pretty soon, but I think that's going to drop on Wednesdays. Is that what we were talking about?
Yeah, the 9th. Yeah, it's going to drop on the 9th.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So, hey, that's right around the corner. Holy crap. We'll be talking about that in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to another fun and festive episode of the Geek Legacy Podcast. Again, episode 350. Holy smokes. If you have a time, go ahead and listen to the Don't Be Crazy podcast. We just celebrated our 100th episode, and I encourage you to check it out. The Pixelated podcast is returning, for those of you that just keep on asking. You will be hearing it shortly. E3 is right around the corner, and we're very excited about it. Had to take a little break, but now the podcast is back in full force. As Dave mentioned, we do have the Escape Pod, hosted by Mr. Randy Van Dyke, where we listen to, or we rather we watch, all the episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation in order, and it has been brutal thus far. So, you have that, and looking forward to recording another episode of the Escape Pod. Thank you so much!